The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
But what Law has tried to do, and he says this in his writings of the time, he said, it would have been easy for me just to introduce money into France, but that wouldn't have solved the problem. There was this huge overhang of government debt, and I tried to address this problem. Unfortunately, he went at it perhaps too quickly, pushed it too hard, and the system collapsed in the second half of 1720.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. We have a guest today, Dave, and it reminds me of what Alex Pollock, a guest that we had about 6 weeks ago, brought up to us, that the financial world really doesn't study economic history. And when he would go talk to some of the bigwigs in the financial world and in the banking world, he was amazed that they really didn't know anything about financial history.
Reading through the biographies that Antoine Murphy has written on Richard Cantillon and John Law, I would say that Antoine Murphy is one of my favorite economic professors. Now, I haven't sat with him in class, but I can tell you that the reason I'm excited about listening to and engaging in conversation with Professor Murphy today is because he's the kind of professor that I would have wanted in my economics class.
Well, you know, he's a biographer at heart. He understands the human behind the economics. And, you know, if you remember when we interviewed Adam Ferguson, who wrote a book about the collapse of the German system back in the 1920s, what we loved about his book, The Death of Money, was that it didn't come at it from a mathematical point of view. He brought it to the human perspective, which, let's face it, Dave, we're humans first.
In that sense, Deirdre McCloskey does the same thing, where you have a certain approach to economics, which is less common today, but is of equal or greater value as it becomes scarcer and scarcer.
We live in a day and age where we talk a lot about John Maynard Keynes. Okay, we talk also about Milton Friedman. We talk about some of the what we call the new economists, as if these were new ideas. But when we were talking the other night about John Law and his sometimes partner Richard Cantillon, we realized that John Law was the first John Maynard Keynes 300 years ago.
And Richard Cantillon, to some degree, was a monetarist.
Yeah, Milton Friedman.
Well, as we launch into our conversation today with Antoine Murphy, there are three things that stand out from the biography on Richard Cantillon, which he wrote in 1986. The first was that unconventional monetary policy, it's not new. It's something that we have seen going back several hundred years and still have today. We just have a new vocabulary for it today. The second thing that stood out was the role of money and credit, which has always been central to bubble dynamics and always necessary to continue to push prices of assets higher and higher. And I think the third thing that stood out to me is that Shakespeare suggested, and I think Cantillon's life reflects this, that the past is prologue. Professor Murphy, several of your interests as an academic in the field of economics deal with the history of monetary thought, with monetary economics, and with macroeconomics as a whole. You've written a number of books highlighting the stories of John Law, and then of Richard Cantillon as well. And many of our listeners will know John Law from the story of the Mississippi Bubble of 1720. I think fewer will know the name of Richard Cantillon, and I think fewer knew about him prior to your biography, but he's certainly no less important. Law was from Scotland, Cantillon from Ireland, and they both found themselves in Paris, France. We'll talk about them more in a moment. You've moved from Trinity College, Dublin, to the Center for International Affairs at Harvard, to then the West Coast to teach a seminar in economics there at Stanford University, along with time at the Hoover Institute. I'm sure there's more we could add to your biography to make it exhaustive, but now by coincidence, we find another Irishman in France. We're curious, in your retirement, are you trading wine? Are you banking? Are you speculating on the Paris Exchange? tell us why you're there, and tell us how Cantillon emerged as that banking figure in Paris from his youth in Kerry, Ireland.
It's far more prosaic, my reason for being in Paris. My wife is French, and we come over to Paris from Dublin quite frequently. And it was on one of my trips from Dublin to Paris that I'd been reading a book on the monetary approach to the balance of payments by Harry Johnson and Jacob Frankel. And I saw a footnote in that. And in the footnote, they said that Richard Cantillon made a contribution to the monetary approach to the balance of payments. And I remembered a lecture that I got in University College Dublin, in which the lecturer described some of the gruesome details of Cantillon's murder in 1734. And I said to myself, I'm in Paris, why don't I go to the Archiv National and the Bibliothèque Nationale and try and find out something about Cantillon? And that started the first 10 years of research on Cantillon, which ended up in this book being published in 1986. Incidentally, there is a paperback edition, which has just been published by Oxford University Press this year, of the book. What am I doing in Paris at the moment? One of the things that I'm trying to do is to sharpen up a play that I've written about dealing with Richard Cantillon and John Law called Millionaires. This, I think, could be sort of opposition to the musical Alexander Hamilton, because in the play I try and show the huge internal debate that went on between Cantillon and Law at this rather frenzied time in 1720, when the world's first stock market boom and eventually collapse occurred here in Paris.
Well, I think the story of his life is one full of drama, and it is fit well for theater. So when you're near completion, I would love to be there for when it opens. It sounds absolutely fantastic. Well, you had the Jacobite capital flight from Ireland to France, and at one point, the amount of money leaving Ireland was equal to 50% of the total Irish money supply. And this really cemented the Irish banking community in Paris, to which Richard Cantillon became a member. You discuss in the biography his transition to banking through working with James Bridges, the British paymaster general and war profiteer. And in this episode, it was clear that creative accounting was not invented by Arthur Andersen. This is not a new fangled thing. And it was not limited to non-GAAP reporting, as corporations use today. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about Bridges and the bridge that relationship became to Cantillon's banking endeavors.
Well, Bridges is an absolutely fascinating character. He was probably the biggest war profiteer of the 18th century. He was the paymaster general to the forces abroad for the British Crown. And in the period in which he was the paymaster, the British forces were fighting out in the Iberian Peninsula in a war known as the War of the Spanish Succession. And that had been going on for about 10 years. Now, Bridges, who would later become the Earl of Carnarvon and still later the Duke of Chandos, as the paymaster general to the forces abroad, seemed to have his finger in every provisioning pie that was available. So, for example, the clothing for the soldiers, the gunpowder for their guns, the muskets that they had, all of these contracts, Bridges would have been insisting with the contractors that he had a certain percentage. He would have taken a percentage on the foreign exchange transactions as money was transferred from London to Genoa and from Genoa to the Iberian Peninsula. All of the time, he's making a very, very considerable sum of money, to such an extent that he builds a huge house outside London called Cannons, which unfortunately was destroyed later. But as a mark of his wealth, he was able to employ Handel as his Kapellmeister, as the head of his chapel. And he could click his fingers and ask Handel to perform some musical activity whenever he wanted. So he's fabulously rich. He's fabulously corrupt. Cantillon, through one of his uncles, who was a banker, got involved with Bridges and acted as an accountant to the troops in the Iberian Peninsula. And there, I think he really learned double entry bookkeeping, because there were books kept for the official files, and then there were books kept on the additional amount of profiteering that was going on. So Cantillon was certainly no saint, and he would have been assisting Bridges make a very substantial fortune. When the war ended, Bridges then suggested to Cantillon to come to London and to work for him. But Cantillon decided no, he would go to Paris. His cousin had a bank in Paris, the Chevalier Richard Cantillon, and he decided he'd go to Paris and become a banker in Paris.
There's a long stretch here where multiple bubbles occur, both in Paris and the London Exchange and then in Amsterdam. And through this, Cantillon makes his own fortune, going from banking to speculating. And after that, he's sort of sitting as a wealthy man with a little bit of time on his hands, other than defending a few lawsuits. And he publishes a book. The first systematic treatise on macroeconomics was written by Richard Cantillon in the 1730s, and it followed his practical experience as a goods trader, as a banker, as an accountant, and then again, as we mentioned, a fabulously successful speculator. How would you contrast Law's ideas, John Law's ideas of fiscal and monetary policy management with what we find in Cantillon's book on economics?
Well, you see, Law is also a fascinating character. I've sometimes described Law, you know, in terms of a tabloid headline, convicted Scottish murderer becomes Prime Minister of France and causes the world's first stock market boom and collapse. Now, despite that sort of very jazzy headline, Law was a very serious economic writer. He wrote a work called Money and Trade in 1705, and in that he really sort of put forward the viewpoint that trade, economic activity, is driven by money. So he didn't believe in the neutrality of money. He believed that if you expanded the money supply, you could expand economic activity and you could lower interest rates in the process. And that's essentially what he did when he took over the French finances after the death of Louis XIV in 1715. Law set up a bank, the General Bank, and started creating banknotes to substitute for gold and silver. And then at a later stage, he set up the Company of the West, and he used this company to take over the French national debt through the issue of shares. And part of the collateral of the shares was the area known as French Louisiana, which was an area stretching from the Gulf of Mexico right up to Canada, bordered by the British in the Carolinas on the east coast and by the Spanish in Mexico on the west side. Now, this was the equivalent of half of the United States. So Law ultimately ended up creating a company which had trading rights and concessions over half of what we would know as the United States today, if you exclude Alaska. So Law's system was a system in which money would be expanded, the rate of interest would be reduced, and economic activity would be increased. Cantillon, on the other hand, would be sort of different in his approach. He believed that there was a real economy out there, and you needed to be careful about grafting on the real economy, a financial economy, and overexpanding the financial economy relative to the real economy. And in his essay on the nature of trade in general, published in 1755, Cantillon really stood out from all the other writers of that period in that he showed that the essence of sort of a good economist was to build a model. And he built up a model from what you might call a single command barter economy to a sophisticated market money using open economy. And he showed how the economy could produce goods and services, how the market system operated, and how at the center of economic activity, you had this key individual, the entrepreneur. In terms of, say, modern day parallels, I think John Law could be regarded as a Keynesian, somebody who believed that monetary and fiscal expansion were good to drive the economy if the economy was at a situation where there was less than full employment. Cantillon, on the other hand, was more of a monetarist. He was saying, look, the market can sort out unemployment problems, and what you have to do is you have to be very, very careful in ensuring that you don't overexpand the money supply relative to the demand for money, And if you do that, then you're going to get balance of payments problems, you're going to get inflation problems, et cetera, et cetera. So I think law could be regarded as sort of a pre-Keynesian, and Cantillon could be regarded as a pre-monetarist in today's parlance.
Fascinating that it was Cantillon who was seeking for market solutions, and yet he had a different view. I know in our commentary, we've contrasted Adam Smith's concept of the unseen hand of the market with maybe the seen hand of central planning. Mm. But Cantillon, I think, had an even more compelling concept than Smith, in that the seen hand was not of the central planner. To him, it was the entrepreneur as the driving force of economic growth and prosperity. So when you're talking about market solutions, you could also substitute the entrepreneur in the marketplace, taking risk and coming up with solutions. Tell us about Cantillon's entrepreneur, in some ways really reflecting his own life as a transition away from a history and heritage of landed gentry in Ireland to needing to find another way, being the second brother in a larger family of boys.
Yes, well, you have to remember that Cantillon was forced out of Ireland. They were sort of lords of the estate down in the southwest of Kerry at a place called Ballyhaig. Then the Williamite invasion took place, and a lot of the Catholic Irish were dispossessed. So they had to leave after the Treaty of Limerick. And he would have had to fend for himself. I mean, there are stories that he arrived in Paris and he had no shoes on his feet. And, you know, he was relatively poor. That would have been before he went to Spain. And when he comes back from Spain to Paris, he is a merchant. He deals in clothing. He deals in wine. But he very quickly finds a seat in the area of banking, and he becomes a top-class banker. But all of the time, as you read the essay, you can see that he's very, very interested in the central role of the entrepreneur. And I think this is very refreshing, because in economics, we've sort of got rid of the entrepreneur. There are very few textbooks in economics in which you find the writer discussing in great deal the role of the entrepreneur. Schumpeter was one of the few people who recognized the incredible importance of the entrepreneur. And Adam Smith, you know, with The Invisible Hand, blanks out the entrepreneur, although he plagiarizes an awful lot of Cantillon's essay in probably his most famous chapter, which is chapter 7 of book 1 of The Wealth of Nations, where he distinguishes between market prices and natural prices. And that's all taken from Cantillon, who had the distinction between market prices and intrinsic value. Intrinsic value was just what Smith replaced with natural price. Now, to Cantillon, the entrepreneur had to be conceptualized. Who is he? What does he do? And here, I think he produced one of the most brilliant one-liners in economics. He said, the entrepreneur is somebody who buys at a known price to sell at an unknown price. And I've challenged many years of students in Trinity and indeed in other universities to produce a better one-line definition of the entrepreneur, somebody who buys at a known price to sell at an unknown price. So you buy up the factors of production, you know the cost of these, you produce the good or service with the factors of production, and then you have to sell it. Now, if you get the price right, you make profit. If you get it wrong, you lose and you go out of business. So the entrepreneur is somebody who has to be very, very close to the market and identify what's going on and be able to work out the price at which he's going to sell the particular good or service that he's producing. And Cantillon, I think, in introducing the entrepreneur to economics, showed economists a way forward. Let's use the entrepreneur as the central driving force of economic activity. You can see that across the global economy at the moment. China has been transformed. Why? Because there are millions and millions of entrepreneurs that have been unleashed. Incidentally, Cantillon talked about these entrepreneurs in China in the 18th century. In the United States, over the centuries, it's been the entrepreneurial drive that has led to the huge progress and prosperity of the United States. Economics, if you think about it, it took an awful turn for worse in the 19th century when Marx came along and sort of classified the socioeconomic differences in society as being between the capitalist and the laborer. And the capitalist was the nasty man, and the laborer was meant to be the good man who should be benefiting from all of the surplus value created by the capitalist. Now, if in fact economists hadn't gone down that Marxian detour, or some economists, and had emphasized more the role of the entrepreneur rather than the capitalist, you don't get all this tension that you have between capitalist and laborer, because the entrepreneur can be a taxi driver living on the same road as somebody who is driving a bus for the public sector. So you don't have socioeconomic tensions. I think when you classify your society as being a society in which you have entrepreneurs and people who work at a fixed wage rate. So there's a huge richness to be found in Cantillon's essay, not only in terms of the way he conceptualized the role of the entrepreneur, but in terms also, I think, of the socioeconomic classification that society is one in which you have entrepreneurs and people working on fixed wages, rather than a society in which you have nasty capitalists versus laborers.
We'll bounce back and forth between this period of the 1720s and modern times, perhaps borrowing some of the intellectual capital from Cantillon to better understand where we're at today. A conversation that I had with Carmen Reinhart last year, we discussed financial repression, and that is essentially the assignment of losses and the corralling of investors into particular categories so that problems can be sorted out from a fiscal standpoint. I think if the entrepreneur is one of these key pieces in the market that ensures that the market works, what happens when incentives shift away from the entrepreneur? Okay, so now it's no longer just buying at a known price to sell at an unknown price, but it's also dealing with how a central planner may be trying to apportion losses, whether that's through a special tax scheme or debt restructuring. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think if you're trying to give Cantillon a voice in this, he would be saying, once you move towards central planning, you're essentially destroying the role of the entrepreneur, and you're going to end up with a very, very soft economic structure. It's going to lose its dynamism. So Cantillon would be sort of saying, you've got to nurture and progress the entrepreneurs. You have to encourage young people to think of acting as entrepreneurs. And indeed, there's a good example of this in France at the moment in President Macron, who's getting a very hostile press. But if you look at it from an economic perspective, he is trying to ensure that there are a lot more young entrepreneurs brought into the French economy. He's trying to reduce taxation on the capital that entrepreneurs are using. And he's really producing a type of Schumpeterian approach to how you can produce almost an economic revolution in France, which is very much needed. Now, of course, there are time lags always involved in these things. You can introduce the policy, and the good effects are going to take 18 months, 2 years, 3 years to manifest themselves in the economy. But I think it's reassuring to see in France that there is at least an attempt now to reduce taxation of entrepreneurs, to encourage their activity, and to get them to grow the French economy.
You know, we go back to this issue of investing in the youth, and you mentioned early on in the book, quoting Jacques Savory, that, you know, advice to parents for budding entrepreneurs is basically stay away from college. Experience has taught us that children whose parents send them to college to study Latin, grammar, rhetoric, and philosophy up to the age of 17 or 18 are very seldom fit for trade. And of 30 there would not be four who would go into this profession if they were not forced into it by their relatives. I think of Cantillon's life and the hardship, which was a precursor to his success. And yes, he earned a fortune, but was Cantillon's real fortune to emerge at a unique time in history? Right place, right time seems to be a prominent aspect of his biography, along with the hardship that he endured to get where he was.
Yeah, I think he would have made money at any particular phase of history over the last couple of hundred years. I think he was just innately extremely bright. And when you have a look at the way in which he got himself involved in the Mississippi system, you can see his intelligence shining through at almost every phase. And here he is, he's in Paris, he meets up with John Law, he listens to what Law's talking about, and he says, yeah, there are a lot of good ideas there. And he agrees with Law that it might be a good idea to send some colonizers out from France to what would be called New Orleans. Incidentally, we're celebrating the tercentenary of the establishment of New Orleans in this year. It was named after Law's mentor, Philippe, Duke of Orleans. Now, Cantillon says, right, Law and myself, we'll send colonizers out, we'll put the investment up, and we'll send them from La Rochelle to New Orleans. He follows Law in the first phase of the Mississippi system. The price of shares rises from 160 to about 2,000, from 160 in 1717 to 2,000 in the early summer of 1719. Now, Cantillon has made a lot of money because he's invested in these shares. But at this stage, he starts using his economic theory and he says, hey, this is a bubble. This thing is going to blow up. And so he decides to sell all his shares and he retires to Italy. Now, you can imagine his concern when he's down in Italy and he buys the gazettes that come from Paris and he sees that he's made a mistake. The price of Mississippi goes up from 2,000 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 to 8 to 9 to 10,000 within the next 6 months. And here he is in Italy, and he's sold out at 2,000. So he's missed out on a very strong phase of the Mississippi system. So what does he do? He comes back to Paris. He has another look at the system, and he says, there's something wrong with this. I thought it was a bubble in the summer of 1719. Now in the spring of 1720, I think it's a massive bubble and it's certainly going to blow up. So what do you do? Well, you take a bear approach to investment behavior. You just sell your shares and you speculate against the French currency. And that's what he did, and he did it extremely successfully. And then in the summer of 1720, John Law realizes that Cantillon is speculating like mad against his system, brings him in and says, look, if we were in Britain together, we could be buddies with respect to what's happening. But we're in France, I'm the prime minister, and you're speculating against my system, so you better get out. So he kicks Cantillon out of Paris. Cantillon continues to speculate against Law's system. Law then realizes that perhaps one of the few people with sufficient intelligence to shore up his system, because the Mississippi system is starting to collapse at this stage, is Cantillon. And he writes a letter to him and he says, please come back and help me restructure the Mississippi system so that we can make it successful. It would have been very strange, a Scottish man and an Irish man running the French economy. Cantillon is too clever, though. He realizes the Mississippi system is in a collapse phase and it's not going to recover. If he goes back, he'll lose the fortune he's made. So he stays in Amsterdam and in London. Then what happens? He sees the South Sea bubble developing and he says, wow, this is another opportunity. It's exactly the same thing that was going on in France. And he gets involved in all sorts of option deals with call options with Dutch financial traders, and he makes a further fortune. So I think the way in which he used his innate intelligence at different stages of the Mississippi system and of the South Sea bubble shows, I think, that no matter what period of history he could have lived in, he would have made a very substantial fortune. He was just very, very bright, and that's what you see coming through in his one known economic work, Essay on the Nature of Trade in General.
You also see that his intelligence is not limited to numbers. He has the sense, after selling out on the first round from 160 to 2000, the Mississippi bubble, to move to Italy, to get out of the way of any political ramifications which may come if, in fact, the system does collapse, knowing that there will be further ramifications. So he understood social, political, economic trends, as well as accounting and some economic theory. So he really is an interesting guy to study. Cantillon's view, I want to compare him perhaps with Jacques Rouff. Imagine a conversation with Jacques Rouff, financial attaché to the British in the early 1900s, and was advisor to de Gaulle to begin to change the relationship between the U.S. and the United States. Cantillon's view of the increase in the money supply leading to a balance of payments deficit. How do you think Cantillon, again hypothetically, would have discussed that issue with Jacques Rouff? We've got the U.S. running a deficit. Rouff called that the deficit without tears. Cantillon assumed that there, if I were to put words in his mouth, would always be tears. How do you think that conversation would go?
Oh, yes, I think Cantillon would have said to him, look, these things always end up with tears, always. Because he said, if you are expanding the money supply relative to the demand for money, there are a number of transmission mechanisms whereby the expanded money supply can manifest itself. You know, it can happen in the bond market, it can happen in the goods market and various types of asset markets, in the consumer good market, et cetera, et cetera. But you're going to have increased expenditure in these areas, and then it all depends on the extent to which the economy is fully employed or not. And if the economy is fairly fully employed, Cantillon would say, hey, this money is going to flow through increased expenditure in these markets and generate a balance of payments deficit. Now, in the early stages of the balance of payments deficit, you may be able to cope, but you can't cope with a continuous and increasing balance of payments deficit over time. You just run out of money. The United States is in the privileged position that it has a reserve currency, but how does it maintain its position as a reserve currency? Well, it maintains its position by not abusing it and by not overexpanding the overall amount of dollars created. But once you have balance payments deficits, that's a manifestation that, you know, there is an excessive amount of dollars in circulation. And if the balance of payments deficit gets worse and worse, then the exchange rate can come under pressure. The exchange rate comes under pressure, you have interest rate effects, and then further down the line, you have something that Cantillon writes brilliantly about, you know, you've capital flight, that people sort of say, hey, this is no longer a reserve currency, this is a currency that I don't want to hold, and you suddenly capital flight out of the U.S. currency, and that can be very, very dangerous.
Well, to some degree, then, it would be an agreement. Rouff would have said, well, this is on this basis, it's why I'm advising the French to take gold instead of greenbacks, going back to the Bretton Woods period, because it can't last, and there will be a consequence, and the dollar will decline. So Rouff ultimately would have agreed with him, it sounds like.
Yes, and I suppose de Gaulle could give himself a pat on the back for identifying the weakness in the reserve currency status of the dollar at the time as a result of the flow of funds out of the dollar. The Americans had to go off the last vestige of the gold standard, which was guaranteeing gold at $35 an ounce. It was a great period to be able to buy gold in those days. Now you're paying, what, $1,200 an ounce.
It's a little bit more. Well, what can we apply from Cantillon's views on velocity to issues such as asset price or goods inflation? Is this what's been called or come to known as the Cantillon effect?
Well, I think the Cantillon effect is really Cantillon looking at the various transmission mechanisms whereby you can have an increase in the money supply affecting prices. And I think what he's doing is he's looking at it in such a way, he's saying, it's not a crude relationship. You don't suddenly have an expanded money supply creating an exact proportionate increase in prices. You're saying if you look at sort of the transmission mechanism, the black box between the change in the money supply and the ultimate change in economic activity as manifested by prices, by GDP, and by the balance of payments deficit, if you look at the black box, you're dealing with a variety of different goods, assets, etc., etc. So, for example, Cantillon introduces a very important distinction between traded goods and non-traded goods, that a lot of goods can be traded goods that are traded over international boundaries and frontiers. And the price of trade of goods is not necessarily going to be influenced by what's happening to the money supply in the domestic economy. Trade of goods are going to be determined, the prices of them, in international markets. So that was quite a sophisticated element for Cantillon to introduce into economic discourse, that you expand the money supply by X percent, it doesn't necessarily mean prices are going to increase by X percent, because there are a whole range of different markets and different economic settings in which the change money supply is permeating through the economy.
Cantillon learned, as we've discussed earlier, some practical trading skills, and it would seem that in the real economy, this is where he kind of was mentored first. Then he transitions to making a fortune in the monetary economy, in the financial universe, and in banking. Contrast those for us and tell us if you think there's a point at which the monetary economy eclipses the real economy in a detrimental way.
I would sort of say more the financial economy rather than the monetary economy, because Cantillon believes money has to be there. You have to have a monetary economy for economic activity to function properly. Now, what he's very much against is, if you like, financial graft on the economy. And this is the type of financial graft that John Law had introduced, that Law is suddenly transforming government debt into shares of the Mississippi Company, and he's monetizing these shares by guaranteeing them at 9,000 livre a share. So Cantillon is looking at this and saying, hold on, Law, by this financial manipulation, by this financial graft of converting debt into a highly monetized financial instrument, has created a financial economy which is way out of line with the real economy. And Cantillon had sort of spent a lot of his intellectual powers in trying to show how the real economy is built up. It's this economy in which of entrepreneurs producing goods and services, etc., etc. But now suddenly you have this added dimension, this graft, this financial innovation of John Law, and he feels this is putting things out of kilter. He knows it has been wrong because he's made a fortune out of backing against the consequences of Law's system. And I think after the collapse of the Mississippi system, he sort of sits back and he says, well, where did Law go wrong? What was wrong with Law's system? And I think his view is that, hold on, you can have a certain amount of financial innovation, but when you have an excessive amount of financial innovation and the financial economy goes out of line with the real economy, be prepared for the worst. You know, stock markets are going to collapse and you're going to get into all sorts of difficulties.
And he's putting these things together in real time because, frankly, the South Seas bubble was almost immediately following the Mississippi bubble. And stock market capitalization at that point reached over 7 times total British GDP. I mean, seven times GDP was just massive, massive. But the Mississippi system, it began to change the French financial system when Law moved into the management of national debt. And I'm curious if there's lessons that you would draw from that time frame that might be instructive to contemporary central bankers who are attempting to keep the world afloat on top of massive central bank balance sheets today.
I think we have to give a somewhat sort of considerate assessment of Law, because Law, when he takes over, say, the monetary system in France, and when he substitutes paper money for gold and silver, I mean, that's very much consistent with the theory that he's put forward in Money and Trade in 1705. He believes money drives economic activity, etc., etc. But then Law says, look, after I did this, I realized that there was a major, major problem. France was almost bankrupt. Interest rates were at excessively high rates if you could actually borrow money. A lot of the time, the crown couldn't actually borrow money. So the French debt structure was all wrong, and something had to be done about it. Now, the policy he introduced was to say, right, we'll convert the government debt held by French transactors, we'll convert that into shares. shares of the Mississippi Company. And for a period, this worked outstandingly well. It worked so well that the French appoint Law as the equivalent of the Prime Minister of France in January of 1720. It's reached its apogee. Now, then Law realizes, hold on, maybe I've pushed the system too hard and too fast. And he tries to restructure it and cut back at the rate of financial growth that's taken place. But the problem then for him is that the political supporters of Law don't want this. They don't want anything that's going to reduce the value of their shares or the value of the banknotes that they're dealing in. So Law is stuck, and he can't really introduce the type of measures that he feels are needed to bring some order, to bring some equilibrium back into the system. And that's his fate, really. Between January of 1720 and May of 1720, he tries all sorts of policies to correct the imbalance which he's created, but to no effect. And eventually, in May 1720, when he's allowed to reduce the value of banknotes and shares, there's huge market reaction against him, and he's forced to resign as the Prime Minister. And then from May 1720 to December 1720, the system is weakening progressively from month to month. But what Law has tried to do, and he says this in his writings of the time, look, he said, it would have been easy for me just to introduce money into France, but that wouldn't have solved the problem. There was this huge overhang of government debt, and I tried to address this problem. Unfortunately, he went at it perhaps too quickly, pushed it too hard, and the system collapsed in the second half of 1720.
Well, and this is a period of time where they're experimenting with what is money. Gold and silver were considered money, and then this experiment pushing gold and silver out of the way is a part of the process. You then have the collapse of the paper experiment, specie, gold and silver brought back in to regain confidence in the monetary system. But at the same time this experiment is happening, you do, if you're a global player, if you're an investor beyond your borders provincially, you can choose the sterling, you can choose the guilder, you can choose other currencies which have real substantive metallic backing. As a historian of monetary policy, which you are, can you see the current fiat system that we have, post-71, post-Bretton Woods, can you see it enduring?
Oh, I think so, very much so. I mean, the problem is that if it doesn't endure, do you go back to the gold standard? And the gold standard, as we saw in the 1930s, and I would say even before then, acted as a terrible anchor to economic growth and economic prosperity. I think as you look at history, you can see something happening between Britain and France from 1720 onwards. In Britain, the Bank of England survived the crash of the South Sea bubble. It continued. In France, the banking system collapsed with the collapse of the Mississippi Company. The French didn't want anything to do with credit creation, banknotes, financial innovation, etc., etc. Right through the 18th century, the French return to a specie system. All they want to do is use gold and silver. So the potential for credit creation disappears to a very significant extent in France. And on top of that, the bubble acts in both Britain and in France prevent IPOs being made by companies. But in Britain, the Bank of England and the Scottish banks, the Bank of Scotland, the Royal Bank of Scotland, the British Linen Bank, and so on. These are the banks that now suddenly move away from a fully backed metallic money standard and start expanding credit. And I think the reason why the British progressed to a far greater extent in the 18th century than the French, even though France was more populous and had a lot more basic economic resources, I think the reason was that Britain had a far more sophisticated financial system. And Britain introduced things like overdrafts, which enabled money to flow through the economy. So I would think anything that move the global economy away from sort of fiat monetary system back to one linked up or anchored to a metallic monetary system would be very much counterproductive. I think what we have to understand is that we have a lot of financial innovation going on, and financial innovation at times can be incredibly important and incredibly good for the economy. Overdrafts are a good example of that, that enabled banks to expand credit and to finance investment. But there's always a tension between financial innovation and financial prudence, and that's the balance that central banks have to sort of maintain. You can have an excessive amount of financial innovation and you get into all sorts of trouble. But you can also have an awful lot of financial innovation, which we've seen over the last couple of centuries, of the banking system developing and financing an awful lot of the capital investment that took place in the global economy. So I think once you balance financial innovation and financial prudence and you ensure that financial innovation is not excessive on the lines of what happened in the United States in 2008 or what happened in France in 1720, as long as you can introduce some balance there and ensure that financial innovation is not massively excessive relative to what's needed in the economy, you can get a prosperous economy too.
Let me give you an alternative read on the Bank of England and the Royal Bank of Scotland, and perhaps you can offer some critique on this. But certainly the depth of the credit markets was necessary for the English to do all that they did in the 18th century. Underscoring depth in the credit markets and willingness to innovate that was confidence. If we assume that confidence has been tied to a stable monetary system through time, and that's in fact what the French were looking for as they went back to the specie system, maybe the difference between the French and what they experienced after the bubble with the Mississippi system, which was really pervasive, it went to the core of the system because it went to the heart of money and credit at the governmental level. And it did not do that with the South Sea bubble, in the sense that the Bank of England had the opportunity to step in and bail out the players in the South Sea Company, and they did not. They did not. And they sidestepped a significant issue which probably would have bankrupted the Bank of England. Yes, gold and silver were still a part of the monetary system, but you have this issue of confidence. And I wonder if perhaps that's what we're dealing with when, you know, today we have a system which is very appropriately, confidence is meted out to hundreds of PhDs at the Federal Reserve. And I don't know how many are sitting on the board and directing the European Central Bank and the Bank of England and the Bank of Japan today, but this is a PhD standard, very different than what we had prior to the Bretton Woods system, prior to what we had Cantillon's preference, a self-equilibrating real money system based in gold and silver. I guess what I'm asking is, is this issue of confidence tied to gold and silver maybe underappreciated as things played out in the Bank of England and how their credit markets developed in the 18th century?
I think it obviously helped. I mean, that there was still this understanding that quite an amount of the credit that the British banks were expanding was backed by gold and silver. But, you know, as you move through time, that becomes less and less so. The banks are starting to be sort of more modern-style credit-creating banks with pretty low metallic money reserves. What happened in France, you're right about the confidence element. Confidence was just absolutely destroyed in the monetary system in France by the collapse of both the Royal Bank and the Mississippi Company. And as a result of that, the French did not want to innovate. The British, I think, were lucky in that the Bank of England stayed out of the South Sea bubble, although in the early stages it tried actually to win the contract for running the national debt, and it was bidding against the South Sea Company on this. But fortunately for the Bank of England, it didn't get it. And then when the South Sea Company collapsed, the Bank of England sort of restructured a bit and continued its activities. So confidence in Britain wasn't destroyed to the same extent that it was in France. But for some reason in France, there was just this absolute reluctance to financially innovate right up to the French Revolution. But then the French Revolution comes along in 1789, and as one knows, in order for a revolution to be successful, it has to be financed. And how do they finance it? They finance it through the issue of paper money, known as the assignats, which initially were backed through all of the confiscated ecclesiastical property and land that the revolutionaries had taken over. But then, once again, the banknotes were overissued, the assignats were overissued. They financed the first 3 years of the French Revolution, but coming into 1794, they're massively overissued. You have massive hyperinflation in France, and the whole system breaks down again. The French lose confidence once again, and they're back to talking about a specie monetary system. And again, I think that makes the French banking system far more conservative and far less innovative relative to the British banking system as you move through the 19th century.
You know, as we get to the end of your book and the end of Cantillon's life, it's shrouded in mystery. And again, we go back to where our conversation began, which is, you know, you're working on a play dealing with the millionaires, and Cantillon and John Law feature prominently here. Well, Cantillon's life accumulated great wealth through his speculations in Paris and in London and in Amsterdam, operating as a financier through that time. Several other speculators took aim at him, tied him up in court, and in 1734, he dies in a house fire. Was it an accident? Was it murder? Or did he intentionally just want to disappear?
Well, that's the intriguing element of the end of Cantillon's life. He was living in London in a street called Albemarle Street, which runs parallel to Bond Street in the centre of London. He was living in a very exclusive type of residence. One of the famous British politicians, Bolingbroke, was living beside him. Now, if you believe the official accounts, it looks as if he was murdered by his French chef with some other members of the household involved in this, that they killed him and set fire to the house, and the house was burnt to ashes. 6 months after Cantillon's demise in London, there's a very mysterious individual called the Chevalier de Louvigny who arrives in the Dutch colony of Suriname in South America. The Dutch authorities don't know who this Chevalier de Louvigny is. He goes into the jungle and he sets up a camp there. They send in troops to locate him. He disappears. Then they relocate him in another area in the jungle again. Troops are sent in to question him. He disappears again, but this time they find some freshly dug earth. They dig it up again, and they find a very large box of documents relating to one Richard Cantillon, Esquire of Albemarle Street, London. Now, the question arises, if this Chevalier de Louvigny was the man who murdered Cantillon, why was he pulling a very large box with documentation relating to Cantillon, which would have been highly incriminating, through the jungle of Suriname? Why had he taken it from Europe to South America? Unfortunately, we don't know who this Chevalier de Louvigny was. Was it Richard Cantillon who had arranged his demise in Albemarle Street? Because, remember, his body was burnt to ashes. Or was it the French chef who had stolen documents and brought them to Suriname? Very difficult to know. I would think it was about 85% chance that Cantillon was murdered in Albemarle Street. Perhaps a 15% chance that he arranged his own demise. And remember, at the time, he was subject to a lot of civil and criminal lawsuits, both in Paris and in London, and that may have given him an incentive to want to get out. One way or the other, it's quite mysterious. And then, almost 21 years to the day of Cantillon's murder in 1755, this Essai sur la nature du commerce en général is published in Paris. There's no author given, but very quickly people say this was written by this former banker, Richard Cantillon, who lived here in the 1720s.
21 years to the day his work is published. The day that he is murdered, if he's murdered, He withdraws 10,000 pounds, not an insignificant sum in that day, from his bank. And again, these are all sort of at the edge of being real evidence. They're circumstantial at best.
Sure.
But it makes for a very interesting story. I would suggest that anyone interested in not only economic history, but a solid tale of wealth, its accumulation, and ultimately the demise of the man at a relatively young age who procured it, it's an excellent book. And fascinating that so few people have written on the life of Richard Cantillon. I think you chose well, Professor Murphy. Oxford University Press offers the book that you put together. They also offer the John Law biography, Economic Theorist and Policymaker, both by Antoine Murphy. I would encourage all of our listeners to order them and engage with them. Thank you, Professor Murphy, for joining us today on The Commentary.
Thank you very, very much.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Antoine Murphy. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can call us anytime at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.